There's no question that the music of 1971 reflected the global struggles of the era. But part of what elevates what's going on is the private and personal strife that Marvin Gaye was going through.
Where he was at that point in time in his life, as Lem and eventually Mel would come to understand, was he was in a state of transition.
That's Justin Tinsley. He's a senior writer for ESPN's The Undefeated, and he's talking about Detroit Lions Hall of Famers Lem Barney and Mel Farr. Tinsley interviewed Lem and Mel back in 2015 about how they came to be friends with Marvin Gaye and ended up as background vocalists on What's Going On. Marvin met Lem Barney in 1968, and Justin says that their friendship began at a critical time in Marvin Gaye's life.
Almost a year earlier, his singing partner, Tammy Terrell, had collapsed in his arm during a performance, and come to find out, she had cancer. And this took a deep, deep emotional toll on him. He was watching one of his best friends slowly succumb to cancer. During this point in time as well, in the summer of 1968, we know about the racial strife and you know, urban decay. And so he was dealing with that. His brother was in Vietnam, and he was seeing a generation of young men just being shipped over to a war that he really, truly didn't understand the purpose for. So it was getting harder and harder for him to sing love songs because he wanted to talk about the world that he saw outside of the studio. So that's where he was in the summer of 1968 in terms of the direction that he wanted to go with his music and what he saw right outside of his front door. You know, there's a quote from Marvin in his biography with David Ritz, Divided Soul, where he was like, I can't sing about love in June when people are out here dying in the streets. I'm paraphrasing it. Those aren't his exact words. But the genesis of what he was saying is, I can't sing about stuff that's not in my heart right now. And what was in his heart was honestly despair. So when he met Lem Barney, because he met him first, and this was the summer of 1968, Lem Barney, he was starting, I believe, his second season in the NFL at that point, and they had training camp. So before training camp, he went to Palmer Park Golf Course in Detroit just to get a round of golf in. And after that, Lem went to the clubhouse and he was like, hey, doesn't Marvin Gaye live here, live nearby or something like that? And they were like, yeah, he lives right down the street. Now, 1968, in terms of access to celebrities, is a lot different in comparison to 2021. So they told him where he lived, and he knocked on the door, and Marvin Gaye knew who he was. And to make a long story much shorter, they established an instant friendship because Marvin was a huge sports fan. He loved the Detroit Lions, he loved the Tigers, and he loved all types of sports. And he was a sports fanatic. He wasn't just a guy that just come to the game to be seen because he was a celebrity. He actually knew the sports in and out.
You tell the story that Mel Farr and Lem Barney actually had a role in encouraging Marvin Gaye to record this song, and that in turn he said he would do this if they would join him and play a part in the recording. Why do you think he wanted Lem and Mel to be part of the background vocals?
So Marvin meets Lem, and he eventually meets Mel, and they form like this almost instantaneous brotherhood. Again, we talked about where Marvin was at this point in time in his career and in his life, and Marvin, he didn't trust a lot of people, you know, but he trusted Lem and he trusted Mel because he knew that they weren't trying to get anything from him. They just enjoyed each other's company. And as, you know, as black men in the late 60s, that type of comfort was everything, because you're living in a country that looks at you as a second class citizen, regardless whether you're Marvin Gaye or you're a professional football player or you're a school teacher or whatever the case may be. They understood what their role in society was and how society viewed them. So there was this brotherhood that formed that was deeper than music, that was deeper than sports. So they hung out all the time. They played golf together. They played sports together. They, you know, drank beers together. So he trusted them to talk about, you know, where he wanted to take his career. And he mentioned it over a round of golf one day that he was working on this song that was a different sound than what he was used to doing. And of course, it was a different sound from what Motown was doing, because Motown was the sound of young America, and it was happy-go-lucky. It was love songs. It was lovey-dovey. It wasn't talking about actual societal issues, and that's what this song was doing. And so he was telling Lem and Mel about it, and he was explaining it, and he was singing some of the lyrics, and they were just like, man, you need to do that song. Like, you need to do it because that reflects our reality. And that is your responsibility as an artist to project that. And he was like, all right, cool. And in a roundabout way, he was like, all right, cool, I'll do it. But if I do it, y'all have to get on the song with me. Once Lem and Mel saw that he was serious, they looked at each other and was like, he's really adamant about doing this song, and we appreciate and we respect and we support the lyrics in the song. So why, you know, if he's serious about it, why not jump on it with him?
When we talk about the lasting message of what's going on, one of the things that's striking is this joy and friendship in the opening conversation between Mel and Lem. Why did you think that the inclusion of that joy is important to the story of a song that is devoted to witnessing pain and witnessing strife?
You know, the black experience in America, it's a lot of things, but monolithic is not one of them. You know, we're not all one emotion every time. And I think the joy that came from that friendship between Lem and Marvin and Mel and Marvin, that joy gave him the confidence and the trust and the vulnerability to really take his career in a different direction. I'm not saying that Mel Farr and Lem Barney are the reasons that Marvin Gaye recorded that song. They're one of the many reasons, but they are a reason, because in that brotherhood where he found this unbridled joy when he needed it the most in his life, because again, remember that Tammy Terrell died in March 1970, right before she turned 25. And that gutted Marvin. That gutted him. He felt that he had lost a piece of his own soul. He cried at the funeral as he spoke. So he's going through all of these different, you know, tumultuous life events. The Vietnam War and his brother over there, and that's really taking a toll of him. Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968, and he's taking all of these things personally. But throughout all of that, he had that friendship with Lem and Mel, and we know the value of a friendship. And once you find a community, a core that you can trust in, that you can be vulnerable in, you feel even more confident to speak on these things. And that's why, you know, that's why the joy of that friendship allowed Marvin to be completely honest on what's going on, because he knew if nothing else, his homeboys had his back. He had support, because he knew he wasn't going to get support from the label, because Berry Gordy hated the record at first until he saw what it did in terms of sales. But he knew he had that support system. He knew, if nothing else, Mel and Lem would be there to support him, because they were the ones that told him, bro, you need to record this song. This song is important and the world needs to hear it.
Yeah. Marvin Gaye ended up trying out for a spot on the Lions with some guidance and support from Mel Farr and Lem Barney. And it didn't quite work out, but Mel told you that he believes this was one of the happiest and healthiest times in Marvin Gaye's life. Did they say anything to you when you were talking to them about maybe that period and what changed for Marvin Gaye to move him into a darker place?
He records the song What's Going On, and he's very appreciative and very grateful for Lem and Mel to be on there. Now, Marvin had been around the Detroit Lions for a couple of seasons at that point. You know, he would come to games all the time. He would hang out with the players and their wives and their girlfriends at, you know, local lounges in Detroit, and he would perform there sometimes. So he was a pretty permanent fixture around the culture of that team. But after recording that song and after seeing the success of that song, and he had his quote unquote teammates Lem and Mel with him, he was like, okay, so y'all were teammates with me on this song. What about me being a teammate with y'all? And they were, and again, the same way when he asked them to be on the song, they were like, come again, Marvin? like, what are you talking about? He was like, I want to try out for the Lions. Keep in mind, Marvin Gaye's 31 years old. He has not played organized athletics, you know, at any point in his life. And now, he played pickup basketball. He played sports just recreationally, but never organized. So they didn't think he was serious, but he convinced them that he was serious. And this guy, he cut all the vices and, you know, the demons out of his life in terms of addiction and alcohol and things of that nature. He improved his diet. He bulked up 30 pounds. He ran 4 to 5 miles every day. He weightlifted. And like, they were like, oh, he's actually serious. So when Lem and Mel took this to their coach, Joe Schmidt, who is a Hall of Famer himself, and Lem Barney is a Hall of Famer as well, Joe Schmidt was like, no, there's absolutely no way that I'm doing this. One, he said, the guy has never played football before, and this just isn't something that you do on a whim. And two, he was like, I'm a fan of Marvin Gaye. There's no way that I would put Marvin Gaye on the football field and have him run across the middle and get, you know, decapitated by Mean Joe Green. He was like, I could never live with myself if I destroyed Marvin Gaye's career because he wanted to scratch a football itch. But after some poking and prodding, Joe Schmidt was like, look, we're having a shirt and shorts tryout at the University of Michigan. And he told Lem and Mel, he was like, tell Marvin to come out. You know, I'll let him run some drills and, you know, that'll be that. But there was no way Marvin was actually going to make the team. But he did get a tryout because there were other people there trying out as well. And Marvin tried out for running back, wide receiver, tight end. And, you know, Joe Schmidt even told me, he was like, he was okay. He was about as good as you could expect a 31-year-old with no football experience to be. He ran routes well. He caught the ball well. He was very coachable. But he told Marvin at the end of the day, like, I can't put you on this team, man. I just can't do it. Like, for your safety and, you know, just for your talent. He was like, your talent is – and your gift to the world is not to play professional football. Your gift to the world is your voice. He said, that's what you need to focus on. And Marvin understood. He was a little bummed out about it that he didn't make the team because he honestly thought he was going to make the team, but he appreciated it. He thanked Coach Schmidt and he was forever indebted to Lem and Mel for doing that for him.
Such a fascinating alternate possible reality. I just love that thought. You know, thinking about the places that Marvin Gaye ended up in his life, after this, you know, this sort of golden period when he had the community of his friends and the community that made it possible for him to record What's Going On. I was thinking about that, the difficult times that came later, and I was thinking about something you said on ESPN recently about the daily pain that every black man has to overcome simply by living in the reality of America. Now, for sure, Marvin Gaye had some very specific mental health issues. But in your research for the piece, was it ever impressed upon you that Marvin Gaye was dealing with the exact same outward pressures that every other black person in Detroit and in America was dealing with?
Yeah, Marvin, as you said, Marvin had his own mental health issues that, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, we didn't know this as mental health awareness. We know that now. But, you know, some of that came from the society that he grew up in. You know, what he witnessed, what he watched, he was very distraught by Malcolm X's assassination. He was very distraught by Dr. King's assassination, the Vietnam War. We spoke about that. And he saw the daily micro and macro aggressions about being a black man and a black woman in this country. So, and he took all of these issues personally, like he put them on his shoulders and it reflected in his music and it made for timeless music. It made for great music. But we don't always understand what that weight feels like when the song goes off. Once the Marvin Gaye album went off in the house, you didn't really know what Marvin Gaye was doing. You didn't know what he was experiencing. And he dealt with a lot of mental anguish, maybe from stuff that he could control, but the bulk of it, was stuff that he couldn't control.
Justin Tinsley, thank you so much both for the initial story that you wrote, which was our last moments with Mel Farr publicly before he died suddenly at the age of 70. We thank you for what you shared with them and what you shared with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's always a joy and pleasure to be here with you.
You can read Justin Tinsley's writing on culture and sports at The Undefeated.